Vicatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Vicatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are undertaking a deep dive into what is arguably one of the most ambitious intellectual projects ever, certainly of the Middle Ages, the Summa Theologica. It's the Summary of Theology by St. Thomas Aquinas.
It really is monumental, but I think the key thing isn't just its size, though it is huge. It's the sheer ambition behind it.
Right.
He's trying to create this single, unified, coherent system for, well, basically all of reality. It's like an intellectual roadmap of existence.
Exactly. And for many people hearing that title, Summary of Theology, they might think, okay, this is just a religious text, maybe not relevant today. Mm-hmm. But the core mission of the Summa was actually to be this kind of intellectual bridge, wasn't it? Aquinas really wanted to show that faith and reason aren't enemies.
Not at all. He saw them as two harmonious, you know, interlocking paths leading to the same ultimate truth.
And that synthesis, that attempt to bring it all together, is really why it still matters so much today, right?
Absolutely. It didn't just organize theology. It profoundly shaped the intellectual architecture of the West, how we think about law, ethics, the basis for human rights even.
It taught us a method for thinking rigorously about morality.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's talk about the man himself. St. Thomas Aquinas, he lived roughly 1225 to 1274, an Italian Dominican friar.
Right, born into nobility, actually. Son of a count down near Naples in Rocca Secca.
Which makes his life choices even more interesting.
Definitely. His family had big plans for him, you know, a powerful position in the church, maybe an abbot, something prestigious.
But he defied them.
Completely. He chose to join the Dominicans, this relatively new mendicant order focused on study and preaching. It was a radical move, rejecting that aristocratic privilege for a life of, well, scholarship.
And the timing of his life is just fascinating, too. The 13th century.
Oh, hugely significant. This was when the complete works of Aristotle were really flooding back into Western Europe, often through Arabic translations. And this caused, well, massive intellectual shockwaves.
Because Aristotle was seen as potentially dangerous.
For many conservative thinkers, yes. Aristotle emphasized pure logic, observing the natural world, empirical evidence, things you could figure out without relying on divine revelation.
So they saw it as a threat to faith.
A direct threat, yeah. But Aquinas saw an opportunity. He saw the ultimate tool, really.
His genius was mastering Aristotle's philosophical framework, the logic, the method, and integrating it quite seamlessly, actually, with Christian theology.
He believed logic could build a stronger case for faith, not undermine it.
Which leads to that famous story about him as a student, right? The dumb ox.
Ah, yes. Apparently he's very quiet, very contemplative, maybe a bit imposing physically. His fellow students nicknamed him the dumb ox because he didn't talk much.
But his teacher saw through it.
His teacher, the great Albertus Magnus, another brilliant mind, supposedly said, "You call him the dumb ox, but I tell you, this dumb ox will bellow so loud, his bellowing will fill the world."
And that bellowing essentially became the Summa.
Pretty much, yes.
Okay, so let's dig into this massive work itself. You said Summa, it means summary or compendium. It's not a story, it's more like a textbook.
Exactly. A highly structured textbook intended for theology students, beginners, as he calls them, though it's incredibly deep. But the ambition, I mean, to explain all of reality, how do you even structure that?
What holds it all together?
It's built on this elegant structure called the Exodus Reditus scheme. Exit and return.
Going forth and coming back.
Precisely. For Aquinas, that's the fundamental dynamic of all reality.
Yeah.
Everything comes forth from God. That's the Exodus. And everything is designed, through its nature and actions, to return to its ultimate fulfillment in God the Reditus.
So the Summa basically traces that entire cosmic journey.
It maps it out step by step.
What I find really striking, even reading parts of it today, is the incredible intellectual rigor he applies to every single point. The method itself is fascinating.
Oh, the scholastic method, yes. Yeah. It's almost like a legal or scientific process applied to theological questions. Every single topic or article follows these five very precise steps.
Okay, walk us through it. It starts with the question.
Right. A clear question, like whether God exists. Simple, direct.
But then he immediately lists the objections.
Yes, and this is crucial. He presents the strongest arguments against the position he's about to take.
Why do that? Why give ammunition to the opposition right at the start?
Because, well, if you can't convincingly refute the best arguments against your case, Your own argument isn't really solid, is it? It's about intellectual honesty, steelmanning the opponent's view.
Okay, that makes sense. It forces rigor.
Absolutely. After the objections, you get the sed contra Latin for on the contrary. This is usually a short counterstatement, often citing an authority like the Bible or a church father.
Kind of setting the stage for his own answer.
Exactly. Which comes next? The respondeo. I answer that. This is the core of the article, where Aquinas lays out his own detailed logical argument, synthesizing reason and authority.
And he doesn't stop there.
No, the final step is critical. He goes back and meticulously refutes each of those initial objections, one by one, showing why they aren't decisive.
Wow, it's incredibly thorough. That method alone is quite a takeaway.
It really is. It's a blueprint for rigorous, fair-minded debate, even today.
Okay, let's follow that journey then. Part one, the Prima Pars, focuses on the Exodus God and creation coming forth from God.
Right, and this is where we find probably the most famous part for philosophers. His attempt to demonstrate God's existence using reason alone, not just faith.
These are the five ways, the quinquiae.
Yes, and it's important to see these not just as abstract proofs, but as arguments grounded in observable reality, things we can see in the world around us.
Okay, so the first couple are related based on motion and cause and effect, right?
Mm-hmm. He observes that things are in motion, but anything that's moving must have been set in motion by something else, and everything that exists has a cause.
You can't have an infinite chain of things moving other things or things causing other things stretching back forever.
Exactly. Because if the chain went back infinitely, there would be no first mover or first cause to get the whole thing started. So, logically, there must be an unmoved mover and an uncaused cause.
Like the first domino that starts the whole chain reaction.
A good analogy, yeah. Then comes the argument from contingency, which is maybe a bit trickier.
This deals with things that could exist versus things that must exist.
Right. Think about, well, us. You and I exist, but we didn't have to exist. We're contingent beings. Our existence depends on other things.
And we won't exist forever.
Precisely. Now, if everything in the universe were contingent like that, it's possible that at some point in the past, nothing existed. But if nothing existed then, nothing could possibly exist now, because something can't come from absolute nothing.
So the fact that anything exists now implies there must be at least one being whose existence isn't contingent, but necessary.
A necessary being. Something that exists by its very nature and doesn't depend on anything else for its existence. It's the ultimate ground of reality.
Okay. And the last two ways. They look at quality and purpose.
Yeah. The argument from gradation notes that we make judgments about things being better or worse, truer or less true. We compare things based on degrees of perfection.
Which implies there must be some ultimate standard, some maximum of goodness, truth, and nobility, which is the source of these qualities and everything else.
Right. And finally, the argument from design or teleology. He observes that even things without intelligence, like plants or planets, seem to act towards specific ends or goals. They follow predictable patterns. They function in orderly ways.
They seem to have a purpose.
Yeah, they exhibit purposefulness. And just like an arrow hitting a target implies an archer who aimed it, this directedness in nature implies an intelligent designer guiding things to their ends.
So after establishing God through reason, part I also talks about human nature.
Yes, drawing heavily on Aristotle here. Aquinas sees human beings as a composite unity, a physical body, and a rational, immortal soul.
And the soul isn't just a ghost in the machine, it's the form of the body.
Exactly. It's the animating principle, what makes the physical matter a living, thinking human body. He rejects the idea that the body is just a cage or a burden for the soul. They belong together.
And that rational soul naturally leads to the question of how we should act, how we live our lives.
Which is the perfect transition to part two, the Secunda Pars. This is the huge section on ethics and morality, focusing on the Redditus, our journey back to God.
Okay, so how do we make that journey back? Where does he start?
He starts with the ultimate goal, the universal human drive. What does everybody ultimately want?
Happiness.
Happiness. Beatitudo. He argues every single human action, whether you realize it or not, is aimed at achieving some kind of happiness or fulfillment.
But he's quick to point out that we often mistake what true happiness is. It's not just pleasure or money or fame.
Right. Those things can provide temporary satisfaction, sure. But Aquinas argues that because our ultimate purpose is union with God, the beatific vision, seeing God's essence true, complete happiness can only be found in the afterlife.
So earthly goods are fine, but they're secondary. They can even distract us if we treat them as the ultimate end.
Exactly. They're means, not the end itself.
Okay. And this understanding of our purpose leads him to his really influential theory about law, the four types of law.
Yes. This has had a massive impact on legal and political thought. At the very top, there's the eternal law.
Which is?
God's own rational plan for the entire universe. The order and principles by which God governs everything. It's the ultimate cosmic blueprint.
And we humans have a special connection to that.
We do. Through our reason, we can understand and participate in the eternal law. And that participation is what Aquinas calls the natural law.
So natural law isn't something written down. It's imprinted on our rational nature.
Precisely. It's that fundamental innate sense of right and wrong. The basic precept is do good and avoid evil. And because we're rational, we can figure out the basic goods we should pursue, like life, knowledge, society, family.
And this is where the idea of human rights starts to take root.
Absolutely. If natural law dictates we should pursue the good, and the fundamental good for us is our rational human nature itself, then any just society or law must respect that nature. You can't have laws that violate those fundamental goods required for human flourishing.
Which leads to the next level, human law.
Right. These are the specific laws that governments and communities create, traffic laws, property laws, etc. But crucially for Aquinas, these laws are only truly just and binding if they're consistent with, or at least not contradictory to, the natural law.
So an unjust law isn't really a law at all, in his view.
In a sense, yes. It lacks true moral authority. Finally, there's divine law.
And this is revealed law, like the Ten Commandments.
Exactly. It comes directly from God through revelation. We need it for two main reasons. First, our reason can be clouded by sin or ignorance, so we need clear guidance. Second, divine law directs us towards our supernatural end, that union with God which reason alone can't fully grasp or guide us towards.
Beyond law, he also talks a lot about virtues, doesn't he?
Oh, hugely important. For Aquinas, a good life isn't just about following rules externally. It's about cultivating internal dispositions, good habits, the virtues.
Like courage, justice, temperance, prudence.
Those are the cardinal virtues, accessible through reason. But he also emphasizes the theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity, which are infused by God's grace and direct us specifically towards him. The focus is on becoming a good person, shaping your character.
Okay, so that covers our return journey in part two. Then we reach part three, the tertia pars. What's the focus here?
This part focuses specifically on Jesus Christ as the necessary bridge, the pathway for that return journey. Creditus.
The incarnation is key here.
Absolutely. Aquinas explains why it was necessary for Christ to be both fully God and fully human. Only as God could continue. He bridged the gap created by sin, and only as human could he act on our behalf and show us the way back. He is the living embodiment of the Creditus.
And this part also deals with the sacraments.
Yes. He sees the sacraments, baptism, communion, etc., as the tangible means, the instruments, through which Christ's grace is communicated to the faithful, helping them on their journey back to God.
But this part, it's famously unfinished, isn't it?
It is. In December 1273, Aquinas had some kind of profound mystical experience while celebrating Mass. Afterwards, he essentially stopped writing.
Just stopped, after all that work.
His secretary urged him to continue, but Thomas reportedly said, "Reginald, I cannot, because all that I have written seems like straw to me compared to what has been revealed to me."
Wow. That's quite an ending.
It really is. He felt he'd glimpsed a reality so far beyond human language and reason that his own monumental attempt to capture it systematically just paled in comparison. He died a few months later.
Okay, let's try to distill some of the key themes or messages from this massive work that still resonate today. First, clearly, is that harmony of faith and reason.
Absolutely central. Truth is one. Reason can discover certain truths about God and the world, and these truths will never contradict the truths revealed by faith. They complement each other.
Like reason can show that God exists, but faith reveals who God is, like the Trinity.
Exactly. And grace builds upon nature. It doesn't destroy it. Our natural capacity for reason is perfected, not replaced, by faith.
A second huge theme is that idea of natural law and objective morality.
Yes, the idea that morality isn't just subjective opinion or cultural fashion. It's grounded in our shared human nature, accessible to everyone through reason. This provides a foundation for universal ethics and human rights talk.
It gives us a common ground for moral discussion.
Mm-hmm. And third, I'd say the focus on virtue for human flourishing.
Right. It's not just about not breaking rules.
No, it's about actively cultivating good habits, prudence, justice, fortitude, temperance. Because these virtues are what actually shape us into the kind of people who can achieve true happiness. It's about becoming good, not just doing good occasionally.
A fourth one might be the intelligibility of the universe, because a rational God created it.
It must be inherently orderly and understandable by our rational minds. That confidence really laid some groundwork for the later rise of science.
Even though the Summa is so systematic and dense, some core ideas really jump out. Let's touch on a few key quotes or principles. That synthesis statement is powerful. Grace does not destroy nature, but perfects it.
That captures so much of his project. God's intervention elevates our natural abilities, our reason, our will. It doesn't negate them, it completes them.
And on natural law, the natural law is nothing else than the rational creature's participation in the eternal law.
It roots morality right in our very being as rational creatures. It's intrinsic, not just imposed from outside.
I also find his definition of love quite profound. To love is to will the good of another.
Yes, it's not primarily an emotion, though emotions are involved. For Aquinas, love is an act of the will. It's a rational, steady choice to seek what is genuinely best for the other person, their true flourishing.
And finally, maybe the principle about knowing God. We can know that God exists through his effects, but we cannot know what God is in his essence.
That shows both his confidence in reason and his humility. Reason can take us far, it can demonstrate God's existence from the world he made. But our finite minds can never fully comprehend the infinite nature of God Himself.
So, how can we, apply some of this thinking in our lives today? What are the real-world applications?
Well, one clear application is integrated thinking in decision making, applying that holistic ethical lens.
So, not just asking, is this profitable or is this legal?
Right. But also asking the deeper questions, is this good? Should we do this? What ultimate human flourishing does this serve? It pushes us beyond purely instrumental thinking.
Okay, that's one. What about application two? Maybe something from the method itself.
Definitely. That scholastic method teaches constructive dialogue. Imagine if, in our political debates or even business meetings, people made a serious effort to first articulate the strongest possible arguments against their own position.
That would change the tone completely, wouldn't it?
It fosters intellectual humility, fairness, and focuses on the substance of the arguments, not just winning. It's a powerful tool for more civil and productive discourse.
And a third application, maybe more personal.
Personal character development,
Yeah.
using that virtue framework. Instead of just focusing on avoiding mistakes or feeling guilty, we can proactively work on building positive habits.
Like consciously trying to practice patience or courage or better self-control in small ways every day.
Exactly. Asking yourself, what kind of person am I actively becoming through these choices? It shifts the focus to long-term growth and well-being.
So wrapping up, what's the final takeaway for you from revisiting the Summa?
For me, it's the sheer power of its optimistic vision, this idea of a rational, purposeful, unified reality where everything has a place and a meaning, and where the human mind has this incredible capacity to understand that order. It's just a staggering monument to systematic thought and the human search for meaning.
Yeah, I agree. And for me, it's that role as an intellectual bridge builder. Aquinas stands between the ancient world of Aristotle and the Christian Middle Ages, between reason and faith, showing they can enrich each other. The Summa remains this incredibly detailed, timeless roadmap for thinking about the biggest questions of existence. It challenges you to think deeply and
A
systematically.
challenge still worth taking up today.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Accotra Foundation.